Interview with Robert Marchman, November 17th, 2009, in New York City by Kenneth Durr. Well, great. Well, let's start with the obligatory background. I noticed that you you were from Brooklyn originally, is that
correct? Correct.
And
born and raised Brooklyn, New York. In what was originally East Flatbush section. I don't know what they call it today, but East Flatbush section, and went to public school in Brooklyn, Tilden High School. And from Brooklyn, ended up going to a small liberal arts college in Western Pennsylvania, in the sticks of Western Pennsylvania, called Allegheny College. Which was a very interesting and different experience from Brooklyn, but one that profoundly changed my life in a very positive way. Gave me the opportunity to explore different avenues of culture, meet different people, expanded my intellectual horizons, met an individual as a mentor who really helped me and direct me and really helped shape out my interest in law.
Okay, who was that?
Robert Sedek, who was a political science professor.
Okay, did you study political science?
I did. I was a political science major. And in fact, when I went to college, my first year, I actually declared my major in political science. I knew early on that I wanted to be an attorney.
Okay.
And Dr. Sedek, Robert Sedek, was someone, he was very well known in the political science department. I was fortunate that he took a liking to me. His area of expertise actually was constitutional law.
Okay.
We had a lot of discussions with regard to the goings-on of the Supreme Court. But he was a mentor of mine. In fact, we're good friends to this day. Which was one of the benefits of going to a small college, that you get to develop very personal relationships with your professors.
So you moved on to Penn after that.
Correct.
It's clear you were going to law school.
Correct.
Did you get interested in securities law or anything like that at that point?
Actually, I didn't. When by background, my father was a New York City police detective, and my brother, who's younger than me, was also a New York City police detective. So I had an interest in the law and actually criminal law. And when I was in law school, I did I did one internship, and I thought that criminal law was where I was going to be headed. I was fortunate. Two things happened between my second and third year of law school. I was fortunate that I was selected for an internship program with the U.S. Attorney, Southern District of New York, and got to spend time in the securities and commodities fraud area. Which was then headed by an individual, Peter Romatowski. He took me under his wing that summer, and it was a phenomenal experience. But that was really my first exposure to securities law. And then the following year at school, Harvey Pitt was an adjunct at Penn. And so I took Harvey Pitt's class, which was amusing because years later we were on the other side of the table in a number of matters. But in any event, so that sparked my interest. And then when I was interviewing for positions, I wasn't interested in going to a law firm because I wanted hands-on experience. I wanted to get right into the fray, so to speak. And I happened to be talking to a law school Penn alum who mentioned that I should look into the SEC. And fortunately, at the time, the commission was just starting a program for graduates out of law school, because prior to that time, it was difficult to get into the SEC right out of law school. So they had started a program, honors program, and I was fortunate to get an interview. I remember the interview well. It was an all-day interview. Went down to D.C., went through numerous interviews, and ultimately ended up staying the entire day and late in the evening interviewing with the director of enforcement, who was John Fetters. Mm-hmm. And one of the few people I actually had to look up to. I mean, literally look up to, because of his height. So it was amusing. But things went really well, and he actually extended an offer of employment to me that day, which I readily accepted. And that was the start of my career at the SEC.
What kind of things did John Fetters and other people say to you about the enforcement division? I mean, this was a time of pretty large change at the SEC.
It was a time of change, but couple of things that I remember, because the way the interviews were structured, you initially started out with the branch chiefs, and if you made the cut with the branch chiefs, then you went to the assistant directors, and you had to wait, and they would tell you whether you should stay or we'll get back to you. Mm-hmm. And then after that, you met with the associate director. I met with Gary Lynch, okay, which I remember to this day going, because it was late in the evening in D.C., 455th Street. And then after that, Gary told me to wait and that we wanted to meet with the director. But the couple things that came through all the interviews, one was the importance of the work of the SEC and what the work of the Division of Enforcement meant to the integrity of the markets and protecting the public. Two was the complexity of the area of securities law, and that for someone who wanted to practice in that area, they had to understand that there were a number of nuances that you had to become familiar with. And at the time it was 1983, but there were still areas that were developing, because in essence the major component of the securities law, the 1934 Exchange Act, was still evolving. And the third thing that stuck with me was just the history of the Securities and Exchange Commission and the division, and the pride that employees had who worked there and those who left. So those were three major facets, if you will, that stuck with me during the interview, and why I was extremely thrilled to be given the opportunity to work there. So it was, and I remember it to this day, I was really going back on the train that night to Penn was really a happy occasion.
I'll bet. It must have been quite a day.
It was.
Tell me a little bit about what your job was like as a young lawyer in the Division of Enforcement.
A lot of that was like yesterday, actually. I will tell you, even to this day, I'm very proud to have worked at the SEC and to be an alumni of the institution. It saddens me to hear some of the things that are going on, and I'm glad that it's the institution is back on the right track. But the one thing that struck me from day one was just, again, the pride of all the employees that worked there. And I was very fortunate looking back. I know there were golden ages when Judge Sporkin headed up the division, and I just missed that. But I became well aware of Judge Sporkin and what he meant for the division. I was fortunate later on to have worked for one of his key people, Dave Daugherty, who was and is a mentor of mine. But you know, when I was there, Ted Levine was a senior member there. Bruce Heiler, Gary Lynch, Bill McLucas. I mean, just people who were phenomenal people in their own right, excellent lawyers, but good people and very committed public citizens.
What kind of assignments did you get?
Did I get? Well, interestingly, right off the bat, I mean, within the first case I had, I remember to this day because I was thinking about it, was an accounting case. And the reason why I remember, because I didn't have much of an accounting background, so pretty much I was thrown into the water. In fact, I remember the case. The case was against a financial institution in Cleveland, Ohio, Broadview. And at the end of the day, we ended up bringing a case against Broadview. It was one of the first cases against a firm and an accounting. I can't remember the firm, the accounting firm, but it was for auditor shopping. What Broadview did is that they engaged in a number of fictitious land transactions to pad their balance sheet, and they went to different auditing accounting firms in order to get a good review. So I remember that because, one, I mean, immediately thrown into that. I was assigned a senior attorney, John Cortade, who was a great guy, but pretty much helped guide me, but said, you know, you're going to be working on this case too, and get prepared for testimony. There were no courses that we were given on depositions, mm-hmm. or so you pretty much had to get a book and observe other people. And I sat in a couple of times with John, and then I was on my own. But the it was phenomenal. I mean, you were within months. Within 3 months, I was taking testimony mm-hmm. of senior people at a financial institution. One of the key people on the other side was an individual, Cy Glanzer, who an SEC alum, who was involved in the Watergate hearings. And so it was just, you know, all this as a young attorney was pretty overwhelming. But the so anyway, we did the case. I had to travel, which I hadn't done much before. I had to go to Florida, Cleveland. So John and I, in fact, I remember our first trip to Florida because they lost my luggage. but it was amazing. Yeah. And so we went to the sites to see some of the so-called purchases that they did. I had to get up to speed on the FASB, you know, the accounting standards. Go pull piece together the case with John, and we were eventually able to make a case that really what this company was doing was just shopping around trying to get a fee. So that and that they had made false statements on their 8-Ks. So that was one of the first matters that I worked on. Then I had a number of you know, some insider trading, not large scale cases. But, you know, it was interesting, after we finished the case, the Broadview case, I happened to run into Cy Glanzer, and this just goes up to the core, the camaraderie of the being an SEC alum. And so he pulled me aside, actually, and just critiqued the way I did the OTR. And you know, said you didn't hear this from me, but it was, it was again, just gave me a sense of why the institution was special, why the place was special. So we did a number of financial cases, and continued to work through the ranks. Within I think a year or so, I had a new branch chief, Richard Murphy, who was a great person. And actually, I was very fortunate. I ended up being in a unit that I had this Richard Murphy as a branch chief, Bruce Heiler as my assistant director, and Bill McLucas as my associate. So it was just phenomenal. And what was phenomenal about it is just the care that they took to help develop their attorneys and me, my legal skills, and ultimately I was interested in management, and they helped me with that well. But what was interesting as my career went on is that at some point I got involved with an insider trading case, and this was interesting, involved Ivan Bolsky. Mm-hmm. So within a couple of years, I must have been there maybe 2-3 years, I actually took Ivan Bolsky on the record.
Was this in the Jeffries case?
Well, this was before, actually, because okay. What happened is, and to the credit of the staff, I didn't know what was going on with the whole Drexel investigation when I took Bolsky. Huh. So I'm taking Bolsky on the record, and unbeknownst to me, on the other side of the wall, so to speak, there's this whole investigation going on regarding, you know, his trading on inside information. I had a case where there were a number of mergers and acquisitions where his account came up, and so I was bringing him in for testimony to ascertain what he knew and when. And what was interesting with that is he was very belligerent, made it clear that, you know, in his view, I was wasting his time. In fact, he was represented by Harvey Pitt. So, and so it was an amazing experience for me, a relatively junior attorney, taking this person who was always in the Wall Street Journal Press. And one of the things that stood out about that is we're in 455th Street in this enclosed conference room, and so it's myself and an investigator and another senior attorney, and he has his entourage of attorneys, and Ivan Bolsky's asking Harvey, is it here yet? Is it here? So I'm thinking he's in the midst of some big merger and acquisition, and they're having the associate run out and check on this delivery. So finally it comes, and it's his lunch, right? A box lunch, which he takes a little bit and then leaves the rest and says, if we want anything, we could help ourselves, and then he left. So needless to say, the guy was just a piece of work. I'll leave it as that. Yeah. So juxtapose that, within a couple of months, I was then brought over the wall, myself and another junior attorney, Lonnie Lee, were brought over the wall and told what was going on and that certain staff were being selected for cases involving the Bolsky matter. And it was at that time that we got assigned to the Jeffries case. So that was phenomenal because, you know, here, you know, you're relatively junior attorney, and you're getting assigned to this major confidential case where we had to fly back and forth to California, take testimony, and ultimately made the case against Jeffries that led to him flipping. So we put together the case.
Now this wasn't just regular insider trading stuff.
No, it was parking. What he was doing was actually parking positions for Ivan Bolsky's account, and in essence allow Bolsky to shield the fact that he had the positions which he had traded on inside information. And also, he was looking for net capital, favorable net capital treatment for his broker-dealer. So we pieced together a lot of information. It was presented to Mr. Jeffries and his attorney, who was interesting. Contrast Bolsky, when we spoke to Mr. Jeffries, and we spoke to him on the record, he was very civil and courteous and gave us what I thought were straight answers. But we ultimately developed a case which was clear based on testimony and correspondence that he and Ivan Bosky were engaged in a scheme to defraud. And he eventually agreed to settle, but did it in a way where it was kept confidential. So once he agreed to flip, and then it got really interesting because we had to bring him in, and the U.S. attorney then got involved and had to actually one day fly him in to the office up to a floor in our building where there were no other persons, you know, bring him in the garage, have him go upstairs, and then debrief him. And so then he really told us everything that was going on. So, you know, it was phenomenal in terms of just getting involved with that case, making the case, being involved with something that you knew was part of a major scandal.
Yeah.
And so that was definitely, you know, without a doubt, the highest profile matter that I worked on, a relatively junior attorney. What was interesting is then after everything broke, we then, myself and Lonnie, had to then go debrief Ivan Bosky. And let's just say he was a totally different individual when we met him the second time. And I said, you know, good to see you again. And so he was much more forthcoming this time. A couple of times we had to remind him of the stakes if he didn't tell us candidly all the information. But so it was different. I mean, I got to see two sides of the man.
Now, did you just debrief him about the Jeffries case?
Well, yeah, in connection with Jeffries. And then there was another component. There was another component of a case that we were working on. Actually with Bilzerian, and that we were going to him to get information to bring out that case, which ultimately resulted in both a civil and criminal action. Interestingly for me, what ended up happening is one of the habits I picked up from college, which is I still have today, is I'm a very good note taker, and if we're in meetings, I can write pretty much verbatim. When we debriefed Boyd Jeffries, I was the note taker. And so years later, actually it was when I started here at the New York Stock Exchange, the Bilzerian trial had started and I was subpoenaed to testify at his trial. And at the time I didn't understand why, but then when they said the notes, I knew what it was about. So, they actually called me to testify. Bilzerian was represented by Art Matthews, who I knew. And myself and another colleague of mine, Michael Missel, who we're good friends to this day, were called down to the courthouse. We were actually represented. It was, you know, it's interesting. We were represented by Colleen Mahoney, who was in the general counsel's office at the time, and now I know Colleen. And what was interesting with that is we're waiting to testify, and Art knew both of us, so he comes in and he says, well, this is going to be perfunctory, and we just need to walk you through the notes that you took, Robert and Michael. You were involved in some interviews, so we need to talk. So we'll get you in and out. So Mike went first, and I had to wait in the waiting room. And while I'm there, I could kind of hear some of the things that are going on to the court. And Art is, I could hear, and he's usually a mild-mannered guy, but I could hear him raising his voice and screaming at Michael while he's on the stand. So Michael comes back. As they come to get me, I see him leaving, and he just... So it was my turn to get in there. Actually, it wasn't that bad, actually. But what was interesting is when I get in the stand to testify, the judge, I didn't understand. The judge got off the bench to... I don't. Maybe he wanted to exercise or something, but he stood off to the side while testifying, which didn't particularly make me feel comfortable. But so anyway, it was fine. But that was another interesting experience that you don't normally get from working as an attorney on a case that you actually then have to testify at a proceeding. So
at this point, this is toward you're heading toward the end of your career with the SEC. Tell me a little bit about the decision to leave to the exchange.
It was extremely difficult, candidly. It was it the reason why I left had nothing to do with the commission. It was personal in that I'd been in D.C. for 6 years. I loved D.C. then. I love D.C. now. I think it's a great place. But I hadn't seen my family that much. Two, and probably with Trump things, is that we were expecting, my wife and I were expecting our second son, and financially I just wanted to be in a better position to provide.
Right.
And but even then, I didn't want to go to a law firm. Because I really like the work of regulation. I believe we fulfill a critical role in society. I like wearing the white hat. I believe, particularly in the United States, that the integrity of our marketplace is paramount to the creation of wealth and capital investment. And I think the job, I still believe to this day, I mean, look at my career, that what we do is important. So I was looking for a middle ground. And fortunately for me, the New York Stock Exchange was in the process of ramping up their enforcement program.
Okay. Why?
Because the SEC had come in and done a review and said, we're giving you two choices. Behind door number one is you invest more resources in your enforcement program. And behind door number two is a legal action. So you pick. So guess which one they picked. So that was why. I mean, the SEC had made a determination that more resources were needed in the enforcement program. And that was beneficial for the New York Stock Exchange for investors. But me personally, because as a result of that, Dave Daugherty was brought on to head up the enforcement program.
Okay.
And Dave had, I think Dave may have come on in late 88, 89. And I had talked actually to Bruce Heiler and Bill McLucas, who were mentors, our mentors, and are good friends to this day, and told them what I was going through. And they suggested, well, look, why don't you talk to Dave? I mean, we don't want you to leave, but we understand it. So I reached out to Dave Daugherty, came up for an interview, and it went great, and he made me an offer.
So what was the challenge here? Resources, of course, but what kinds of things did needed to get done that weren't getting done here?
Well, it's interesting, because I harken back to my days at the experience of the commission. One thing was just to enhance the reputation and let the industry and the public, and particularly the SEC, know that we were serious about our jobs. Because when I was at the commission, self-regulatory organizations were not looked upon in a favorable light. There were concerns about whether or not folks were beholden to the industry. Were they going to do their job in a serious nature when you came across violations? So the challenge was not only to develop a disciplined program, but to get the message out that we were serious about business. And bringing in Dave sent that message. If people know Dave, one thing about Dave, and I've gotten to know him and been very fortunate, I mean, Dave is a pillar of integrity, but he's very serious about what we do as regulators. And so to me, that was one way to send out the message, because he wouldn't have taken a position unless he was given free rein to do what needed to be done, and that's what he did. So they expanded the middle management ranks. I was brought in as the equivalent of a branch chief.
Okay.
It was working to build up the culture and discipline and making the staff understand the importance of our work. and also to the member firm community that we were not going to tolerate nonsense if we didn't.
What kind of transition was it coming from a regulator to a self-regulator? Was the setup different? Were there things that you took you a while to get used to?
I tell you, one of the things that took me a while to get, what was helpful was Dave being from the SEC. There was that bond. I had a free rein to be serious about what we were doing, high expectations, commitment to excellence. So from the culture, in terms of what I wanted to implement, that was an issue. Personally, the issue was getting a handle on the language of a exchange and trading market. Mm-hmm. Working at the SEC, the cases that I worked on were at a high level. So I was doing accounting work, financial fraud, corporate fraud. Didn't really do a lot of the market trading cases. So when I came here, had to familiarize myself with market at the close transactions, limit, or I mean, all this language, and my head was spinning. So you had to familiarize yourself with the language, the terminology, also, you know, conduct inconsistent. What's that? How do you apply it? That, you know, that's our like catch-all umbrella term. When I was used to 10b-5. So you had to familiarize yourself with that. Having to understand that, unlike at the SEC where we had the tool of a subpoena, for an SRO you don't have subpoena power. So it's folks, you reach out to them and tell them to come in, and they can cooperate or not. But we did have the tool that if they don't cooperate, we could bar them.
How much did you use it?
Not that much, because what we did is, we used it when we had to. We didn't have to use it a lot, but one of the things we did, and I was involved with this with Dave, is we, the bar up until maybe the mid-90s or so, was one that was an open-ended bar. So if you failed to cooperate, when you decided to come back, you cooperate. The case may be stale, and if you cooperated, then we would allow you back in. We changed that, and we went to the board here to get approval to change it, that if you failed to cooperate, there would be a trigger within 6 months to turn that into a permanent bar. So it raised the stakes that you no longer could just sit on the sidelines, wait for time to pass, and then decide one day, hey, I want to come in. Now that raised the stakes. So with that additional tool at our disposal, we really didn't have to use it that much. I mean, if someone was in the industry, let me distinguish, if someone was in the industry, we didn't have to use it that much. If someone was out of the industry, they may have decided that they weren't interested, but we then would use it. But for those folks in industry, and particularly with firms, we didn't use it that much.
Okay. So you're looking at people who are on the floor and brokers, mm-hmm. and essentially just looking for evidence that people are doing things that they shouldn't be doing. Where are you getting this information? How much of it is market surveillance developing?
A lot of the information that we... Well, let me... I'll tell you just my career here.
Sure.
One thing that was interesting when I started. So when I left the SEC, sad time for me personally, because I loved the place. But I was working on a Drexel case at the end, and that got to be a little bit of a drag. So one of the things that happens, I figure I come here, no more Drexel, because then we work on another case. So within a year, or less than a year, the exchange decides it's going to look at the supervisory aspects of the Drexel case, and particularly Fred Joseph, Mike Milken's supervisor. And because one of the issues was the SEC, based on you know, Section 15 could not bring a supervisory action against Fred Joseph if they didn't have evidence of an underlying violation. So, being that there was at the time not much going on with him, the exchange decides they're going to look at that. And also Drexel, because they were a major member firm. Mm-hmm. So I was tabbed to the Fred Joseph case. And as a branch chief and then with another staff person, but I kind of wore two hats. I actually was a manager, but I actually did a lot of hands-on work, which resulted in having to go to California and talk to people out there and take Fred Joseph on the record and all this stuff. But interestingly, at the end of the day, we ended up making a case against Fred Joseph and actually did bring a case against him for a failure to supervise. And I think it was the only action that was brought against Fred Joseph by a regulator in connection with the Drexel case. So
so what was the penalty then?
We gave him a couple of years bar, supervisory bar, and I believe there was a fine as well. But, I mean, it was hard fought because the point they kept trying to make was that these things were going on and were concealed from him. And we were able to show, in essence, the reason they were concealed is because you didn't bother to look.
Right.
And you had a responsibility as a supervisor to do certain reviews and see what the office looked like, little things like that.
Right.
So, but that was interesting. I mean, that was interesting.
That's an example of something that everybody knew that this was going on. Tell me about what percentage of your work at that point was stuff that you were generating internally?
At that point in time, the bulk of our referrals came from firm filings because at the time, member firms were required to file Form U-5s when they terminated an employee with us.
Okay.
And so the bulk of our cases came from firm filings. Member firm examinations, because we had the member firm reg group here. This is all pre the formation of FINRA.
And is this just looking at the information that the members routinely provide to you?
Yeah, it's information the members routinely provide. It's the results of examinations that were done by our member firm examiners.
Okay.
And then there were some market surveillance referrals based on the surveillance work that was done. And that would be looking at the work of brokers and specialists with regard to things like the failure to maintain a fair and orderly market, issues with regard to a broker trading ahead, things like that were picked up. But I would say at the time, the bulk of our work was from the filings that the member firms themselves made. And we also had cases based on the what we would read in the newspaper, and also we would get sometimes tips, people complaining, but definitely the bulk of them were for the member firm filings.
In the time that you're with enforcement, you moved over to market surveillance after a period of time, right? In the time you were in enforcement, did things change? Did you beef up everything, or was there some specialty that you moved more?
No, I what happened in enforcement, I mean, I was fortunate. I moved up the rank. I was promoted to a vice president, department head, and didn't have a specialty per se. But one of the things that I did get involved with was that when the research analyst matter broke, Dave Daugherty assigned me to head up the investigation for the New York Stock Exchange and enforcement group. And that was a pretty amazing experience as well, because you had all these regulators who were involved with the case. You had the New York Attorney General. you had the SEC, you had the states, you had New York Stock Exchange, and you had the NASD. So we're all involved in this case and trying to work out a strategy so we're not all tripping over each other, and also trying to work out a strategy that everybody feels that they're playing a key role in the case. So we eventually worked out a strategy. I mean, that was pretty much led by the SEC. Steve Cutler was heading it up. And what was interesting for me is we actually, when it first started, and we were supposed to try to keep it from the press, we actually had our initial meetings in this building, and that were attended by Elliot Spitzer and Steve and the key heads of all the SROs and their lieutenants and or senior people, and then representatives from the firms. And what we did is had the attorneys come in on Pine Street, the back street, to avoid the press, because at some point the press found out that we were having the meetings here. So one day I come into work and like there are all these camera crews right in front of the building, waiting for us to, to come in. And fortunately, we had them go in the back. But that was a pretty interesting meeting as well, I would say.
You talk about everybody finding their role in
right.
this team.
Mm-hmm.
What was the thing that the stock exchange was sort of looked upon to do? What was your part in this process that couldn't have been done by any of the other parties?
I would say ourselves and probably NASD as well, to give them credit, was the focus on the supervisory aspects of the firm, because for all the cases that we conduct and conduct now, supervision, focusing on the internal controls, processes and procedures, those were things that we were very familiar with. And we also were very familiar with just the operations of a firm. So we were able to give the other regulators some insights as to operations. And when some firms said they had a separation between the investment banking and the research analyst, and when you really scrutinize it, it's nothing more than a thin veil which can be easily pierced. You need to be able to have a discussion as to why it's bogus. It's not really a wall at all, and it's very transparent when there should be a brick wall that prevents the flow of information. So the role we played were be able to provide some insights based on our expertise, and it all, in my view, at the end, worked out. I will say one of the, as I've been in the industry and have looked at how the SROs have been viewed and their involvement, the research analyst case and some other matters that I've been involved with the SEC, even of late, demonstrates to me that there's definitely more of an acceptance from the SEC as to the ability of the SROs and now FINRA to do arm's length important work without concerns that we are somehow beholden to the industry. I mean, there's definitely a trust factor there. There's more cooperation. There's sharing of information. We're involved with meetings with a variety of different regulators, whether they be at the state, federal, we're part of that team. And to me, that's an important development, because given that we don't all have all the resources we would want, and I say that because you would never get, if anybody asked you about resources, you would always say you never have enough.
Right.
So with that said, it's important to efficiently and effectively use resources that are dedicated to the regulation of the market, and you have to use them wisely. So it doesn't make sense, for example, for the SEC to duplicate a matter if we can do it efficiently and effectively and get the right outcome at the end of the day. And I've seen that evolution over the years, and it's one to me that's important and at the end of the day benefits the investing public and maintains the integrity of the market. I think that's an important development.
Now, is it right? I seem to recall that in this period of time when the regulation is still, you know, part of in with the exchange, mm-hmm. that regulation was something like half the people or close to half the people in the whole organization?
Correct. Yeah. At the time, at New York, about 50% of the employees were in regulation.
How would you get people to come into the regulation side and, you know, build careers there when they could maybe make more money doing something else?
We would have discussions. Well, one thing that we had to make clear to people, because we still had to deal with, I think, some perception issues, is just the quality of our program. And that, the SEC has a phenomenal reputation, and in my view, will always have a phenomenal reputation. So they're, you know, viewed as the gold standard. But you have to let people know that you're aspiring and working to be right there with them, and that you're trying to work as diligently to have the same outcome, and that you're putting the resources in. That you take what you do very seriously, and that you want to dissipate that mentality that this is a 9-to-5 place. It's not. Mm-hmm. So we've impressed people with the commitment to our jobs. You get people who are committed to what we do, and it hasn't been that hard of a sell. I mean, you do have a number of people out there who understand the importance of this work. You know, having the middle ground, if you will, between being with the government and an SRO in terms of salary, mm-hmm. it's a nice middle ground. I mean, you that's important as well, benefits and everything. So that enables you to live comfortably and live comfortably, but do the right thing.
Did you? During this time or even after, did you ever sort of get the sense from the people on the market side that the brokers are unhappy, that, you know, they wish you guys would cut it out or something like that?
I mean, I will tell you, it was interesting because, I mean, we talk about my career. The as we fast forward to kind of what ended up with the corporate governance changes and there was a lot of rumor that, and particularly with this whole thing with Dick Grasso, and that somehow we were being influenced. For the people who have that mindset, to me, they didn't have an understanding of who was running the enforcement program, Dave Daugherty. If they had known Dave Daugherty and what Dave stood for, they would have known that Dave wouldn't have tolerated. He would have left. He just would have said, this is not for me, particularly being mentored under Judge Sporkin. So for me, in fact, it was interesting when I interviewed, that was one of the things I talked to Dave about, that I didn't want to come to a place that was a step down from the SEC because of what I thought of the SEC, my respect for the SEC, the people at the SEC. And Dave had said, Robert, that's what I'm working toward, and I want you to help me get there. Mm-hmm. And so that's what we did, and I think we accomplished that goal. But the point I will tell you with Dick, I only have one experience with him where even the issue was raised about our work. And actually, and I remember because we were brought to his office, Drexel had raised an issue about our doing the investigation because of the SEC work and thought it was piling on. So they reached out to him, and we were called to his office. And Dick said, if we didn't do our jobs and didn't do the work, he would fire us. That was my only exposure to the person who supposedly was influencing us, okay? So my point is, the business, the folks on the floor may have complained about things, didn't see our perspective as terms of why we saw certain things important and not minor. You can't trade a head on the floor, even if you, it's in some, it may be something with the operations of a handheld, but if you do it, it's a problem. It's serious stuff. I never was felt influenced in any way while I've been here to do my job. Now, you know, I'm in meetings with the other side, they're complaining, you know, whatever. That's been my take and continues to be my take. There's been a number of things, you know, that have happened here since I've been here. I mean, we used to be over at the World Trade Center, and I was here on that day, so we collectively as a team, thank God no one was killed in our group, but we collectively as a team pulled through that. The exchange went out of their way, because we were the only division actually that was over at the World Trade Center. And the exchange went out of their way to, and it was Dick Grasso actually, to give credit where it's due, went out of the way to make sure we were back in business. People were pretty surprised how quickly we were back in business. Mm-hmm. I mean, within months, they had a temporary space for us. We had all the technology. We were back in business. It was amazing how quickly we were back online doing our work.
And then you came over here?
Yeah, then we came over to 14 okay. Wall. So we were over at 20 Broad for maybe a year or so. Okay. And then we came over the 14 Wall.
Okay. In the highlights, you the World Trade Center, and you've got the Dick Grasso, imbroglio, I guess you could call it. And sometime in there, you're talking about the floor and front running,
right?
And you know that blows up into the next big thing.
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit. I mean, and you're either you're in market surveillance or you're close.
No,
to
I hadn't at that time. I was in enforcement, and the interesting thing with that is, look, the specialists, some specialists on the floor, there's no other way to put it, defrauded the investing public, and they abused their privilege and unique privilege of being on the floor and trading on behalf of the investing public. So they just abused that privilege. Mm-hmm. And folks who did that deserve to be whacked. From here, from this vantage point, I was in enforcement, and in fact, I was once again tasked with leading that investigation on the enforcement side by Dave for the Division of Enforcement. So we served as partners with the SEC, their NERO office, and that was interesting because
what office?
The New York. I'm sorry, the New York. We shorthand the NERO, but it's New York Regional. But the New York Regional office staff ran the investigation, so we partnered with them in doing the investigation. And you know what was interesting with that, and what kind of got lost in everything, is that. That case came to light because of a market surveillance analyst doing a review of surveillance alerts, you know, kickouts, and saw a pattern that was unusual and raised it up the ladder and then eventually got to the SEC. Now, there were some issues in terms of how quickly it should have gotten and all that, but it was the exchange that identified the problem, and this goes to the issue you were talking about earlier about the value of surveillances, because that was instrumental. And so we partnered with the New York. They naturally they had concerns about what was going on there, and how much could we be of assistance since it was could be viewed as a negative for us. But we said, look, if there's a problem, we want to find it, no holds barred, and that's the way we work with them. So we work with them. The Office of Compliance and Inspections and Examinations was intimately involved in the matter because they had come in and done examinations. I mean, that was part of the problem. They had done examinations previously, and apparently surveillances were not tweaked in the way that they had recommended. And if they had been, maybe things would have been caught earlier. Even with that said, the surveillance that they had in place did find the problem.
Yeah.
So in any event, I led that investigation. It resulted in fines of, nearly $250 million.
When you're trying to figure out how to keep this from happening again, I assume you look at why it happened in the first place.
Exactly. You have to do an analysis.
And the question that I have is, is this something that just got bigger over time? Due to structural changes or technological changes, why did this pop up at that point?
Well, you did have an evolving market, so the market's changing. I think in terms of the structure, that may have had an impact on it because we moved to decimals, right? So that has an impact on the spread and what the type of transactions that could be done. Systems that were in place were changing in terms of technology, and I think that may have had an impact on the ability to do these trades. So all that snowballs into a situation where folks are gaming the system, and they're trading ahead in a way that is below the radar screen, because that was one of the issues with the case. It wasn't that like an insider trading case where you have someone who didn't trade before and now all of a sudden they're making a $500,000 trade and it blips up on the screen and you're saying, wow, what is these trades? There were a lot of small trades that added up when you add them up to millions of dollars. So that's the other issue, that you had to scrutinize the trades, review a lot of the trades, match them up with the technology to make sure you were doing matching up the right trade. So it was a very intense and in-depth, but as a result of that, that led to changes in the system, just like, and I wasn't intimately involved with this, but I was aware of it, with the Oakford scandal, with the brokers, the floor brokers, where floor brokers gamed the system because of a lack of technology with regard to the order trail of their orders. And they were able to trade ahead, hold orders in their pocket. When they saw something was profitable, put in an order for their own account. And as a result of that, that led to a system now, an order trail that was put in where now the trades are followed and we're able to track. With this, as a result of this whole fiasco with the specialist trading ahead, and with the move from the manual trading to the more electronic trading, what was done is that the trading system now is hardwired and the rules are embedded into the system. To the extent that, for example, the system will not let the specialist trade ahead. The certain limit order display functions that will be triggered. So now the rules are embedded into the system, and that was a result of you need to learn from the experience. Now, it was at that point where I kind of went over to market surveillance to head up market surveillance. Rick Rick Ketchum came in as a result of the fallout of the specialists and the Dick Grasso fallout, and also concerns about, you know, looking at the corporate governance of the enforcement and market regulation and market surveillance. So a separate board, independent board, was set up,
right,
to independent directors. Rick Ketchum is brought on as the chief regulatory officer, CEO of New York Regulation. And within a year, Rick asked me to move over and head up market surveillance to help the transition to really a new model. We were going into a new market, the hybrid market, so systems had to be changed. One of the major things we had to do, very candidly, was to regain the trust of the SEC. That was one of my major challenges, to regain the trust.
How'd you do it?
Well, I did it with a lot of communication, and a lot of outreach, and a lot of transparency into what we were doing. Whenever we did have an issue with new systems we were trying to implement, we called and let them know.
Who were you talking to over there?
OC, with John McCarthy, for the most part. But we let them know proactively. I mean, the worst thing to do would be for something to happen and them to read about it in the newspaper. So that never happened on my watch. I mean, if something happened, we would let Rick know, and then we would call them. So it was a lot of communication, a lot of dialogue, a lot of listening to what they had as recommendations. And eventually, over the 3 years I was there, we did see a change where, and I brought on a new team. I brought on some people from the outside. John Malitzis was a key person who was in the industry, was at the NASD, was well known in the industry by folks in terms of someone who knew the markets, trading, was worked with Rick previously, brought him in to play a key role in market surveillance in the area where there were concerns, moved some other people around. But I wanted them and the outside to know we were very serious about what we were doing. So it was focusing on where we needed to make enhancements, lessons learned, talking to the SEC. The other thing was also to have a dialogue with the industry, our members, firm community, reach out to them and letting them know that, hey, look, not everybody down here is a crook, but you gotta work together. You guys need to proactively flag things for us as well. So if you're seeing issues, you need to let us know, and we'll work to have more dialogue. So we had more dialogue with them as well, and I think that helped because they, when there were some issues, they raised them. We established periodic meetings, monthly meetings. It was a very hectic time because we're in the process of going from a manual to electronic.
Right.
So there were a lot of systems changes, transition. All those systems changes resulted in impact on surveillances because you had to have a surveillance in place to monitor the new system.
And it sounds like you could get to better surveillance that way.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, when you went to the electronic trading, you could put in systems that would more readily follow the audit trail of trading in the system. So that helped. And then putting in blocks, if you will, with regard to the trading, for example, Rule 92, if there wasn't certain, if the system recognized a customer order and the specialist tried to put in a principal, it would block the trade from taking place. So that made it easier. I mean, automatically, those things happened. So we had to work through that. And I think at the end of the day, and then on top of that, the exchange was sued by the commission, they brought in a regulatory auditor. I mean, that was part of the settlement, and had to work with the regulatory auditor. Again, the same thing: open transparency, letting them know that, you know, hey, we want to work to get this right. So if they have recommendations, and I think at the end of the day, it was painful, but at the end of the day, it did result in a better surveillance program and a better program for the exchange.
So, and this is also the point at which you've just set up the separate board, so you've essentially split mm-hmm. regulation.
Correct.
Did that make a difference day to day very much in the way things happen?
Not really. Yeah. I mean, again, the the key is who's the chief regulatory officer. Rick was phenomenal. I mean, it was a pleasure to work for him. I mean, without a doubt, he is one of the brightest people I've ever encountered. I mean, his grasp of the market, of market issues, whether it's the nuances of market trading rules or financial operation or even enforcement matters. I mean, his grasp and ability to conceptualize issues is just phenomenal. So it was a pleasure for me to work with him during the short time I did. I do have some feeling of regret that he left because he's such a good guy.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that too, because first you've got enforcement split off, and mm-hmm. then you've got essentially, you know, the whole piece goes away.
Yeah.
How did that change your day to day working in enforcement at the stock exchange? I guess my big question is, how do you decide what's going to go to FINRA?
And that's important because a lot of people still don't understand that. I get jokes now that, I mean, it was funny. It was about a year and a half ago. Penn, the law school, invited me to be a keynote speaker at a event. They annually have a securities regulation institute. And where they come in and have all these speakers, and at the end of it, so I think it's a 3-year program, but at the end of it, you get some certificate. So anyway, they invited me in to be keynote, and the professor who runs the program says to me, I didn't know you still had a job. So this was like right after the FINRA. But in essence, here's how it worked. Internally, a lot of anxiety from the staff, wondering what's going on, how's that going to impact our work, because people are committed and dedicated to what they do. At the end of the day, to me, it all worked out well. And, you know, we're looking for efficiencies and effectiveness. But how it changed our focus, and at that point in time, I also came back to enforcement, to head the division enforcement. What it means for us now is, you asked earlier, like, where do we get most of our cases? Then we got most of our cases from the filings, from the firms. Those would be the sales practice type cases. Now we get the majority of our cases from market surveillance, because we are focused on the market trading issues. FINRA is focused on the member firm issues. So it's basically the sales practice, financial operation. And so if you look at the types of cases that we bring, they're cases that deal with trading on the floor or impact the New York Stock Exchange. Now, since the merger with Archipelago, ARCA, and the merger last year with Amex. So, for example, earlier, like a month or so ago, we brought a case against an individual who was violating Reg Sho, circumventing the options market maker exceptions to allow other broker-dealers to affect naked short sales. And it was a profitable setup for this individual because he was getting commissions on these so-called trades that he was setting up. But we ended up bringing a case against an individual for $4 million. So we'll do those. We'll do cases that deal with, there may be some trading ahead, but it's not the trading ahead to report. It's more, our rule says you have to document if you get approval to trade along with an institutional customer. Some of the firms don't document that they get the approval, but it is a violation if they don't. So those type of things, market manipulation mm-hmm. cases. So those are the type of cases now that we have. FINRA, which is still, by the way, pursuant to a regulatory service agreement, doing some work for us in an enforcement vein, although those cases are winding down. Those will be primarily the sales practice cases. Those will be the, like they were major market timing mutual fund cases. Those will be the type of things that they will handle. And that's basically the split now.
Have you found that you're able to focus more on what you're doing, given this more
finite
portfolio?
Yeah, not. You know, what I would say is what it does is it just narrows what you're looking at. But remember, we were a much bigger division prior to the merger, so you had more people who could look at the different type of training. So, it doesn't change. I mean, our procedures haven't changed. The manner in which we do the job hasn't changed. We're still committed to excellence here and continue to do that.
Terrific. Well, thanks. I've taken more than an hour. Is there anything that we haven't talked about that we should?
No, I appreciate the opportunity, and it's. I will just say again, to have, and I do to this day when I'm talking to students who are in law school or junior lawyers, I still do not hesitate to recommend the SEC as a place to work to start one's career. I think it's a phenomenal institution. I'm glad to see that things are back on the right track, and I hope they'll continue to do so. But I feel privileged to have had the opportunity to work there.
Terrific. Thanks a lot.
Sure.